Poet Robert Pinsky says he has a kind of pitying mistrust toward all literary criticism. On the other hand, Pinsky also writes literary criticism. In fact, his new book of essays, Poetry and the World, has just been nominated for a National Book Critics Circle Award for criticism. Pinsky is also a professor of English at Boston University. He grew up in a small town on the New Jersey shore. In one of his essays, he writes that he's interested in the process of mythologizing and glamorizing. I asked him how that relates to writing about his hometown and growing up.
I think there's a typical relation to a provincial place, a kind of a crummy little place, where the person who grows up in it and then feels not a complete success in it, sometimes that person then becomes the curator of the place. My town, Long Branch, New Jersey, is something that still preoccupies me. Times I've been back there, it looks to me obliterated. It's just a terrible mess. The boardwalk that I remember is mostly gone. There are condos there. And it occurs to me that I'm the one who takes care of that old Long Branch of the 50s and 60s. I am still writing about it and thinking about it. It's mine now. And perhaps someone else who was in school and did very well and was happy with themselves socially and academically has accepted the change of the town. I'm still back there trying to do it over right.
Well, there's a poem that I think is a real perfect example of your description of yourself as the curator of the town. Would you read your poem, The Questions?
Sure. I probably should say that my dad was one of the many people who had stores on the main street in the town. My grandpa had a bar. My father sold eyeglasses. What about the people who came to my father's office for hearing aids and glasses, chatting with him sometimes a few extra minutes while I swept up in the back, addressed packages, cleaned the machines? If he was busy, I might sell them batteries or tend to their questions. The tall, overloud old man with a tilted, ironic smirk to cover the gaps in his hearing. A woman who hummed one prolonged note constantly. We called her the Hummer. How could her white, fat husband, he looked like Reverend Peel, bear hearing it day and night? And others, a coquettish old lady in a bandeau, a European. She worked for refugees who ran gift shops or booths on the boardwalk in the summer. She must have lived in winter on Social Security. One man always greeted my father in Masonic gestures and codes. Why do I want them to be treated tenderly by the world now, long after they must have slipped from it one way or another, while I was dawdling through school at that moment, or driving, reading, talking to Ellen? Why this new superfluous caring? I want for them not to have died in awful pain, friendless. Though many of the living are starving, I still pray for these, dead, mostly anonymous, but Mr. Monk, Mrs. Rose Vogel, and barely remembered, that they had a little extra, something for pleasure, a good meal, a book, or a decent television set. Of whom do I pray this rubbery, low-class charity? I saw an expert today, a nun, wearing a regular skirt and blouse, but the hood or headdress navy and white around her plain, probably Irish face, older than me by 5 or 10 years. The post office clerk told her he couldn't break a 20, so she got change next door and came back to send her package. As I came out, she was driving off with an air, it seemed to me, of annoying, demure good cheer, as if the reasonableness of change, mail, cars, clothes, was a pleasure in itself, veiled and dumb, like the girls I thought enjoyed the rules too much in grade school. She might have been a grade school teacher, but she reminded me of being there, aside from that, as a name and person there, a Mary or John, who learns that the janitor is Mr. Woodhouse, the principal is Mr. Ringlaven, the secretary in the office is Mrs. Apostolakis, the bus driver is Ray.
Can I ask you one of the questions that you ask in your poem? Why
Yes.
do you want these people to be treated tenderly by the world now? Why do these people preoccupy you now?
It's such a mystery. It's the mystery of why we care about those we know. And I suppose the traditional religious injunction to love your neighbor as yourself, if you extend it to love your neighbor's children as your own, and I think many of us even do strive to do that, but there's some sense in which the old lady I knew means more to me than the old lady you knew. And so, at some level, it's really appalling. I mean, each of us with his own little teddy bear that he liked. And I think it's worth thinking about a long time. If I could answer the question, the poem would have been called The Answers, Terry.
Well, one of the things I find interesting, though, is that when you were growing up, these people lived in the world of the adults. But now that you're older, these people live in the world of your past, the people who were the minor characters in your past, and now you're kind of excavating them in a way, maybe to better understand your past.
Perhaps so. It comes back to that interesting question of why some people become the holder of something that was. Dublin didn't think it was Joycean, to take an example of the greatest of modern writers for me. Dublin didn't feel Joycean to itself, and Joyce couldn't live there. He became an exile from it. And now, Dublin is Joyce's Dublin. That Dublin is, anyway. And why that happens and how it happens is peculiar. Probably if I accepted these people and their world more entirely, I'd be back in the town selling eyeglasses and hearing aids to their equivalent. And it was some feeling of difference then that makes me ask myself what the feeling of sameness or closeness is now.
I'm sure that the bus driver named Ray and all the people who you mentioned by name in this poem would be astonished to know even that you remembered their names, let alone that you were including them in a poem.
That's part of the thrill of the poem. They'd be particularly astonished because I didn't like the principal, so I made him the janitor. And I made the guidance counselor the secretary. I didn't care for her much either. And I liked the secretary very much. Her name was Ringleben, so I made her principal. So if they're out there, I'm boss in the poem, just as you were boss in the school.
Right, this is the power that you have now.
But the other people, Mr. Monk and Mrs. Rose Vogel, were called Mr. Monk and Mrs. Rose Vogel.
Let's get back to something we were talking about before. We were talking about how you're interested in the process of mythologizing and glamorizing, and you explained that you sometimes use that to go back to the past and to penetrate the past and maybe even better understand the past. Do you do that in the present? Do you think that you mythologize and glamorize the present through writing about it?
I think everybody makes all day. I think that art is an extension of the kind of things that people do in a housing tract. When it first goes up, the houses all look alike, and 10 years later, they're landscaped differently. They're painted differently. People have added to them differently. And as sloppy as we may look when we get dressed, we are making little works of art that are how we look that day. And for me, making poems is just a kind of very conscious and specialized extension of that making. It isn't only mythologizing and glamorizing. It's making something of it.
You've written that sometimes you're afraid that poetry has just become hobby, that it's just seen as hobby now.
I suppose that's a sour way to put something that's also one of the glories of poetry. That is, poetry isn't a commodity. We never read in the paper that a Sydney sonnet has just been sold for $3 million, the way a Rembrandt painting might have been. You know, and you memorize a poem, it's yours. And it's just as good as somebody who can buy the manuscript and hang it on their wall. And because poetry's instrument is one person's voice, and its material is words, which we all use every day, there's an extent to which poetry resists being turned into a commodity. And so if there's a glorious word for a hobby, that means an art that does not easily lend itself to being bought and sold, then maybe I should accept that.
Well, thank you very much for talking with us and for reading some of your poetry.
Pleasure. Thank you, Terry.
Robert Pinsky's new book of essays, Poetry and the World, is published by Echo Press, which also published Pinsky's last collection of poems, History of My Heart. This is Fresh Air.